You spend time with your family?
Sure I do.
Good. Because a man who doesn't spend time with his family can never be a real man.
I know this is the right thing to do, Dad, because I would die for this kid, just so he wouldn't have to feel 1 ounce of sadness.
That's why you're here right now, to protect me, to be scared for me.
To be a good father. And that's exactly what I'm gonna be.
Hello, Dad? Yeah, I just wanted to say I love you.
Hi, Mom. Could you put down the phone for a sec?
This front kind to Papa.
Hey, Dad? You want to have a catch?
I'd like that.
Whoever's listening, whoever needs some help feeling like they're not alone in this battle of parenting, welcome back to the Dad Pod. Today we have a very special guest sitting alongside myself and Tom Habershaw. It is the one, the only, the academic phenom, Chuck Habershaw. Welcome to the show. Tom, why don't you tell us who Chuck is?
That's my brother. That's my big bro.
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me. And what an introduction. I am an academic powerhouse, that's for sure.
Yeah, we'll get into that, Chuck. Don't you worry, pal.
Oh, I don't doubt it, but watch out for what's coming back your way.
Oh, I know. Well, I want people to know that Chuck is the coolest older brother possible, like ever. We're talking about a guy who used to dunk on people in high school. And if you had any older brother who could dunk on dudes in basketball games, that was awesome. Not only that, you were a voted class clown in high school?
Yeah, master of ceremonies for homecoming as well.
Your nickname was Tank Ass because you just got a huge
Well, that was my pledge name. That didn't come in until Lehigh happened.
It just the coolest.
So you could box out. You could box people out in the pickup games.
Yeah, could, can, will open. Yeah, you got no shot.
Chuck, tell him about who's the center for St. Joe's.
Oh, TJ McKenzie. Yeah, so TJ McKenzie was 7 foot tall, recruited to play at Providence, and I jumped the tip against him, and it was, I guess, obviously, probably my most memorable moment was winning the tip against TJ McKenzie. And the video is funny because it's everybody laughing at how short I am compared to him. And then I win the tip and we proceed to lose by like 45. But it was that one moment is pretty funny.
Yeah, you're like crouching down, like kind of.
Yeah,
like,
I was ready to jump. I was going as high as I possibly could, which was pretty high back then. And he was probably like, I'm just going to, you know, get an inch and a half off the ground and win this thing. But That was a fun moment.
Chuck, is you say you're 6'2"? Is that what you're checking in at now?
In high school, it's probably 6'1", but I think I gained a little bit.
Yeah,
6'1", and everybody thought I was like 6'6", but no.
The height inflation on the high school basketball programs in Connecticut, Fairfield County, Connecticut. Let's talk.
Yeah.
Like you were, I think you topped out at like 6'6" at one point in the
program. Yeah. Some publications, I was like a 6'6" incoming junior when I was really like 6 1/2 inch, like 6 foot, 0.5 inch. So I was like, it made no sense, but it was high school ball. You know, you play, if you're able to get a rebound, you're now the center. And so that's where I was. And I was a 6 foot center.
Well, listen, I put 6'6" on my Tinder profile and that's how I got Prim. She was a little disappointed when she met me, but, by that point, I already had her.
Yeah, Chuck, whatever. Do you know Prim Saripapat? She's a Duke phenom, tennis phenom at Duke, and they have a kid named Duke. So,
wow.
I don't know how this is going to go over well over there, Chuck.
Not going to go well at all. I was actually talking to last night, you know, watching Mike Krzyzewski complain about, you know, it's tough to play during COVID and everything. I'm thinking, well, I bet you'd be fine with it if you were, you know, 6-0. But you lose a couple at home. Oh, this, you know, this COVID thing. This is brutal for us. You know, okay, Coach Ken.
This is a guy who made sure we had a Carolina bathroom, a UNC bathroom growing up.
Oh, this is the brother who made sure that happened, because you told us about that last week.
Yeah. This the UNC, so didn't get into UNC, but and obviously didn't get into Duke either. But we were big UNC fans. We went to basketball camp there for like 7 years. I used to dunk in the Dean Dome, which was awesome. A real game, just in camp games. We're big UNC people. Tom doesn't like to hear that, but big UNC guy, Tom.
Well, Tom explained it to us that he was like the biggest UNC fan, and then fortunately or unfortunately, however you want to look at it, he ended up still in the ACC, but at Wake Forest, and everything turned out pretty good since then. But yeah,
he couldn't get in.
There's no way.
Yeah. I think Vince Carter blocked you from UNC is what happened.
Oh, yeah, man, don't open up that flesh wound.
Yeah, that is – whatever. I mean, how did that happen? Nobody ever knows.
It's the biggest mystery in sports. I mean, forget me. It's the biggest mystery.
You do like a investigative report on just that, like a nice podcast of like 10 episodes talking about how the 6 degrees of Kevin – of Vince Carter. How the heck did I get, you know, bounced by him?
Makes and no he's sense. A podcast host. Like, he's like a media superstar. And yeah, it's just, yeah. It's terrible. Well, he's beating me at my own
sycophant,
game.
Sycophant Tom learned well from Woz. He's hoping this gets aggregated.
Well, Chuck, not only was Chuck the coolest dude coming up, my admiration, and he's going to hate that I'm going to say this, my admiration for Chuck has only grown since he's been a father, which is why we have him on the dad pod today and not just the little brother, big brother pod. Chuck has 4 kids. He has his oldest son, Charlie, my nephew, is 8 now?
Yep, he's 8. We got Lainey is 6, and then twin 3-year-olds. Which is great. They're twin girls, Eve and Grace, and who just ruined a second remote control. So they put one of my remotes for the TV in the fire last winter, and then they just put one in the dishwasher yesterday. So they're just a pain in the butt. Can I swear on this thing?
Oh, what? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Let it roll.
No. So they're a pain. But yeah, those are my 4, you know? Very lucky. So happy. How old is Duke?
Duke is 2. And he's awesome. We got super lucky. I will tell you, and I think this is a perfect transition, because there are what, 3 kids in your family or 4? Tom, 4. Yep. No, but I mean amongst you guys. Yeah, 4.
Oh, there's 4.
So I could not imagine being a parent to, or being a sibling to, 4 kids. What was that like growing up, you know, for you guys?
Yeah.
As far as like getting attention from your parents or making sure you could do everything. I mean, I just can't imagine.
Chuck, I don't think I've ever asked you this. I don't even know. Do you remember me being born?
I remember your first passport photo. I think that was my first. Your first passport photo, I wish we had it. He looked like an alien, a complete alien. Like there's something wrong with this kid. You know, I was like, this is my brother. This doesn't look good. And yeah, so that I remember that. I don't remember. I was 6 when you were born, right?
January 86.
Yeah, I don't really remember that. I remember the move to Brazil and all that, which happened while you were 3 months old. And you know, the famous story you're talking about, how you grow up with, you know, three siblings or whatever. The biggest thing is when you're the oldest, your parents think you're like a teenager when you're like five. So at six, we moved from New Jersey to Brazil, and my dad got like three vans with the stuff, like all that. There was like, you know, 27 pieces of luggage going, like the entire house was going to Brazil because we were going to be there for years. And so we had three vans. One was my mom with the 3 month old twins, Tom and Kim. The other one was my dad with Steve, who's four at the time. So what do you do with the third one? Sure. From New Jersey to the airport, you send your 6 year old with a random guy and a van full of luggage in 1986. And you say, hey, dude, I'll give you any amount of money as a tip if you make it there. Now, how quickly would my parents be arrested if that happened? If I did that with my eight-year-old, I'd be arrested on the spot. But then, you know, and I still think I mean, what are you supposed to do? Like, just send all your luggage with a guy? I guess you have the collateral of your kid in there. But
or that's a ransom, either one.
I mean, I don't know what's worse, but and my parents didn't think anything of it. You know, it was just like, yeah, this is what we got to do. This is how we're going to get to Brazil. Like, what?
Do you remember that move to Brazil? Like, I can't even imagine telling Charlie, like, hey, we're moving to Brazil.
I remember hating it because I had all my friends and I was like, I'm never going to see them again. And then the flight you guys have probably flown it. I know Tom has a ton of miles flying. There were twin 3 month olds sitting there for a 12-hour flight. I mean, what a nightmare. What a nightmare. You just put everybody in through. And my mom had pneumonia at the time too, so she wasn't doing much.
What?
It's just a disaster.
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, mom was sick. Her friends didn't want her to fly to Brazil that she was so sick. So, and they just did it. Because, I mean, what are you going to do? That's kind of the motto of a parent of four kids. Just like, just plow through it. Whatever. I mean, I'll do whatever I can do here. Because it's always a disaster if you try to get the perfect situation.
I'm just at a loss. I don't even know where to start with all that. Like the amount of like jokes, questions, comments, criticisms, and amazement all stuck in my head at the moment are through the roof. But so as you guys get to Brazil, how long did you guys live there for?
4.5 years.
So what was it like? Did that like bring you all closer as a family? Because I'm assuming you didn't speak Portuguese when you got there, Chuck. And like, did that make you guys closer as a family, or did it cause tension? Do you remember any of that?
No, I remember. Yeah, I think it made us closer. But the, you know, you living there, growing up there from 6 to 10 and a half is a very different thing than living here. From, you know, it was, I, you know, I remember a few things from down. I remember most of it, but one story, again, as being a parent, you just are doing the best. It's kind of like Home Alone. So like I got every day you would take the bus, you know, and for some reason it was fine. But, you know, it was a pretty violent and crazy time in Brazil. So they just take a school bus, and they actually played music on the school bus, which was awesome. So they play like Bon Jovi, I remember, and a bunch of other, you know, like recent hits for 1987 on
Rick
the bus.
Rick Astley, I'm imagining in my head.
Yeah, and everything. And the bus took me to our hotel where we were staying at before we moved into our house. And I got there and just went up to the room and nobody's there. My parents had moved with the other three to the house and forgot to tell me or the school that we moved. And so I was left at a hotel in Sao Paulo, Brazil by myself until somebody realized, oh shit, where's Charlie?
Oh my God. And I just picture, like, even though Man on Fire took place in Mexico, I'm picturing like that level of like,
yeah,
danger for a kid.
Dude, you when you're in that moment, I just remember being like, what do I do? I think I was still six or maybe seven at that point. Like, where do I go? Who do I talk to? I don't even speak the language.
There's no cell phones. It's not like you can hop on your phone and just be like, yo, mom, pick me up.
Yeah. Yo, mom, you screwed up. You sent me on the wrong bus.
There's little memories, little like vignettes that I remember of Brazil, the pool in our backyard. We had like, I remember just a lot of green, a lot of like trees and stuff, like palm trees. I remember chewing on magic markers, the tips, like the little like ink tips. Yep. But mostly when I left Brazil, I just have little pieces of it because I was 4 and a half when I left. And I was still young enough that like, whatever, I might have had like a couple friends at school, but I'm imagining Madeline, who's 3, turning 4 soon. Like, she has friends, but if we move to the next town, it'd be okay. Chuck, I think I know that it was really hard on you, but moving back to the States when you were 7.
Yeah.
I
moved back to the States when I was 10.
You're 10 and a half moving into Westport, Connecticut.
Fifth grade, moving from São Paulo to Brazil to Westport, Connecticut was a little, little bit of a culture shock. I showed up in jams and my hair was spiked and I was like as tan as anybody. And they all thought I was legit like a Brazilian kid, because I was. I mean, really, I was. And got a lot of hazing for that. And yeah, it was very different trying to, make it normal for me here when it was completely backwards from everything I had grown up with, the previous 4 years, which is like you're saying, like the formative years and even pop culture. Like in Brazil, we had one TV channel. Here, everybody's watching WWF back then, and I didn't know who any of these people were. I was like, Hulk Hogan, who's that? And pretending that I knew, and like I didn't know any of this like cool swear words. I remember that. Like, I don't know what these people are saying. And then I remember Steve, the other brother, who's like a couple of years younger, who was more, he and I were like, okay, we're gonna have Portuguese as our secret language. Now, how weird would that be? Like yelling for your brother, like, você como vai? It's like, what are you talking about? You're such a loser, Charlie. But yeah, it was very different moving back here from there. It was like a whole different experience. But and I remember getting recruited to play soccer because I'm a Brazilian, right? And I'm a big Brazilian. And they were like, wow, this guy, he must know how to play soccer. So they recruited me for the travel team and put me at attack when I was a goaltender in Brazil. I was the goaltender playing with these kids that were like unbelievable. And I was a decent goaltender. And then I come here and they're like, all right, play attack. I'm like, I don't know what that means. What am I doing? And I'm slow. And I'm like, they're like, this kid sucks. Yeah, I do. I'm not good at this. It's fine.
Were mom and dad, in retrospect, now that you look back on it, way harder on you than me?
Yeah. Well, I think that happens anyway with as you have more kids, you just don't really care that much about the next few.
What were some of the things you didn't get allowed to do that we got allowed to do?
And I had curfews like through high school of like 11 o'clock and I'd have to come in, say goodnight and all that stuff. And then, so that leads me to Lehigh where, they're all holds barred. Like I just go do whatever the hell you want. It's up to you to wake up in the morning. It's up to you to put yourself to bed at night. It's up to you, whatever. When I was here, it was like, mom waking me up in the morning. You got to be home at this time at night. You can't hang out with those people. You can't do that. You're not allowed to sleep over there. And then you go to school and it's like, whoa. And I remember, Tom knows this, but I was supposed to play basketball there. And I get there and just had so much fun that the first, like, I think it was 2-3 weeks in, I was supposed to be going to, what's the Stabler Arena? Is that it?
Yeah. Was Coach Sal Mentisana? Was that your coach who
recruited you? Yeah, I think it was Sal. So I was supposed to be a walk-on, right? I was supposed to you know, whatever, be one of those guys who just does all the work and never gets any of the accolades or whatever. So whatever. So I go there and I'm supposed to go to Stabler Arena every like Saturday and Sunday at 6 a.m. to train for like 4 hours. And there was a bus that would pick us up in Lower Sense. I was in Lower Sense. And I remember coming home when they were getting ready for the bus. And I was like, they're like, yo, Chuck, you coming? And I'm like, I'm not coming. I need to sleep. They're like, Jesus, dude. And I'm like, yeah, I'm having a great time here. So yeah, that's when the basketball, you know, took a little brief pause there. But
did you feel ill-equipped to go to college when you did?
Absolutely. I should have, if everything was done over again, I would have done a PG year. I was way too immature to be sent to college.
Like, how did we grow up in the same household and I didn't feel that way at all?
Well, I was also young. I was like 17. I turned, what was it, 17 when I got there. You know, I was just young. I wasn't ready for that. And it just, you know, like I remember my buddy Durs, I made him do like my college my papers in senior in high school. Like, I was just coasting, you know? And then you get there and you're like, oh, this is way different from high school and from anything else. So,
Tom, do you remember your brother having academic challenges? Like, you, cause you might've been just young enough to take that in and be like, oh, I can't have that happen. But I don't know.
I remember Chuck's like first GPA. What was it, Chuck? It was like 0.7.
Yeah, it was
.86. Yeah. And I was like, how is that possible? Like, trying to do the math in my head, being like, I didn't even know that there was such thing as a .86.
Yeah, no, it can happen. And my second semester, like a 2.9 or something. And then I got a .73. And that was when they were like, yeah, you're done. Like, okay.
What was like, cool.
you don't have to never come back, but don't come back for a while. Like, all right, fine.
What was cool is Chuck came home and we just played video games together all day. All day. Yeah, we played GTA and I think SOCOM might have been in there.
I remember that one. Yeah, that was weird.
So it was kind of cool because I got like my brother back. And he came home and lived with us for a while he was getting his life back on track. I think you started working at New York Sports Club. Was that when you started working there?
Yep. I was a personal trainer for a little bit.
And you got jacked. And
I was going to – and here's another one. I was going to play basketball at Fairfield U and then busted my foot, my ankle, just completely destroyed everything in my ankle. I had surgery to repair it. Did it playing ball. I remember I was watching the N1 mixtapes a lot then. And I was doing like skip to my loose stuff.
Yeah. Rafer Alston.
Yeah. And it, you know, playing with old men. And I was like, you know, flying, like I had like 1% body fat or something. I was like a like athletic specimen at that point. And I'm flying around with these like guys my age now, like 41-year-old guys kids and like can't jump anymore. And I landed on a guy's foot and everything snapped. And I was like, why was I doing this? Like, what am I doing jumping around with these people? Like, just run your jump shot. Don't go inside the paint. Nobody's leaving the ground. You're just going to land on feet. And yeah, so it was brutal. But that, yeah. And then, so that basketball thing flew out the window again.
People listening to this might not comprehend how important basketball was in our family.
Like, yeah.
It was huge.
Yeah, it was definitely. When I saw Tom's first jump shot, it was just gross.
Was it a family? Was it like really like a family thing? Like your dad, you guys, like
Tom? I mean, no. It was my dad wanted us to play baseball more, I think. He didn't want us to play football. We weren't allowed to play football.
You weren't allowed to play football.
I wasn't allowed. See, here we go again. Yeah. I wasn't allowed to play football. And then Tom played football and he did pretty well at it. You know, Tom was like a mini fridge, but he was young.
Mini. He was like stressing the mini. Yeah.
Yeah. Mini refrigerator Perry. but yeah. I remember when I, cause I was what is 6 years older than you, or six or seven, whatever. When you're 15 and you have like an 8 or 9 year old brother, there's nothing more fun than just having, you know, I was like getting to figure out how to play pretty good basketball. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to teach this kid all that I know about basketball. And I coached him and everything.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And we had some of the most fun times ever was coaching these teams that were pretty terrible. And then we'd make runs in these things. Like I coached a travel team. I coached
my eighth grade travel team. You coached our third grade, fourth grade rec league. Yep,
that was the first year. Yeah.
So that was also just the best. Was like all these kids had their dads as the coach, and here I had my brother. And
I got in trouble one game because we were up two right at the end of the game, and they were inbounding the ball to, you know, 10 seconds left. Or no, we were up three. Yeah, up three. And I just had everybody sit down on the court. And I was like, hey, go ahead, score two. I don't care. You're not going to win. And so the referee, who was my friend, was like, dude, you can't just have these kids sit down on the court. Like, all these parents are here. I'm like, why not? These kids are going to sit down on the court. They're going to make a layup, and then the clock will run out, and we win by one. Fine. And they're like, no, that's not how this is supposed to work.
Like, well, brilliant guy.
I was ahead of my time, really, in the analytics.
Analytics, yeah. Three is more than two, which some teams in the NBA still haven't figured out somehow. So you come back home. You get your life back together. You get Lehigh out of your system, which is hard to do, as Ben can attest. It takes years for that to happen. And then and you go to Fairfield, and what I remember is you got like straight A's at Fairfield. You're a finance major. You start working for Dad at his investment advising firm, and that's where you work now with your, I wouldn't say high school sweetheart. You guys didn't date in high school.
Yeah, I didn't know her. I actually met her at Lehigh when I wasn't a student at Lehigh. I was there visiting for the weekend and met my future wife there via a mutual friend. So very strange. Okay. Yeah, I met my wife at college and I went to high school with her, but I didn't meet her at high school. I didn't know her at high school, and I didn't meet her while going to the college, which is weird. But yeah. Yeah. So we were so in love. It was her birthday yesterday, 40. Oh, did I just say that?
We just got to make up a name for her now.
Yeah. Yeah. But we got married Pinehurst, and here we are.
But Chuck, you were in the New York Times.
Oh God. She hates that. Yeah. We were in the New York Times on the real estate section for buying a home together before we were married.
Ben, listen to that. He and Jackie were featured in New York Times because they bought a house together before they had actually gotten married. And it was like this new trend in, I mean, whenever that was, and they were like the feature couple.
Isn't that weird? 2009, you know, so long ago, it was weird and frowned upon to live together before you were married.
It's so weird. Like, I'm trying to process the idea of that being newsworthy in any sense.
It was the front page of the real estate section of New York Times. I got so many random people who, like, you know, because that's like the big one of the, well, you know, I don't know about nowadays, but it was like the biggest section people would go to first on Sunday New York Times, real estate section, like, check it out. And it was like guys from college and guys from high school are like, dude, I just saw you on the thing. I'm like, really? And it was, you know, it was Katie that got that hooked up, Tom.
Oh, Katie, our cousin Katie, yeah.
Was in PR at the time, and she's like, they're pitching this article, and I was like, oh, Chuck would do it. And I did it, and I was like, oh my God. And the worst part, and you guys can relate to this, Jackie, my wife, hates how she looks in the picture, but also I'm wearing a winter coat and she's not. And everybody's like, dude, why didn't you give your wife the coat? Like, it's freezing. There was snow on the ground, and I'm like, oh shit.
You're that guy.
I look terrible in this thing. God.
How do you guys feels today? Let me tell you, Feels is a better way to be. Our premium CBD will keep your head clear and help you feel your best. It reduces anxiety. It reduces pain. It reduces sleeplessness. Feels naturally helps reduce stress, anxiety, pain, sleeplessness. Place a few drops under your tongue and feel the difference within minutes. Are you new to CBD? Well, Feels offers a free CBD hotline to help guide you through the experience. Me personally, had a couple of restless nights during this whole pandemic, wasn't sleeping great, did a couple of Feels the next day, boom, out like a light that night. You know, get a little joint pain because I'm getting up there in age, a little Feels CBD under the tongue, boom, joint pain gone, greatly reduced. It's so easy to use. It's so good for you. It's just the better way to do your life right now. It will naturally help you feel better. And there's no high, there's no hangover, there's no addiction. You can join the Feels community, get the Feels delivered to your door every single month. You'll save money on every order, and you can pause or cancel at any time. Become a member and get 50% off your first order. 50% off. It has me feeling my very best every day, and it helped you too. 50% off your first order with free shipping by going to feels.com/ding. That's feals.com/ding. Become a member. 50% off, taken automatically off your first order with the free shipping. That's feels.com/ding.
It was hard to imagine, like, in 5 quick years, you were, like, flunking out of college, and then suddenly you were on the cover of the New York Times for getting your life together, for, like, buying a house.
I know. What a guy, huh? What a story.
And you have Charlie right around the time that I get married. So that was 2012.
Yep.
And how cool is that to have a son? And did you want to name him Charlie? You knew you were going to name him Charlie, just like, or our father's name is Charlie and his father and whatever.
Yeah. I figured that was probably the easiest thing to do, was just name him Charlie and be done with it. He's a great kid. It's really cool. I had always thought I'd have all boys, which is a whole different thing because I have now one boy and 3 girls, but so I got my boy, and, you know, I'm training him hard, you know, let's go. No.
as you have your Staples basketball, half zip sweater there.
Yeah.
Grooming him to be the next Staples basketball star.
Is that your guys' high school?
Yeah. So that was cool. You guys can relate to this. Like, the first outing I had was actually Tom's wedding right after he was born. He was like 6 weeks old. And so I went solo to the wedding, which still Jackie's mad about that she didn't come too. But we went to the wedding. It was like my big outing. It was like, you know, whoa, this is what it's like without a kid, even though it was like a 6 week old. It's like not even a real thing yet.
It's like Lehigh all over again. You're like, whoa.
I know. I was like, oh, here we go. Let's go, boys. But it was more like, oh my God, I got a bed I can sleep in without like just get some sleep for once in the like 2 months. But
let's be honest. I barely know you, Chuck, and I'm guessing you were the instigator of all things that probably could have gotten the wedding called off. Like, I just picture you showing up to Tom's room with like bottles of hard alcohol and shots being had.
Yep.
And maybe like the pushing things, instigating it late enough into the evening where if Allison knew you were still up, she'd have been a little annoyed.
You know, there's a lot of that. The best thing is that that I know, you know, because I coached him and was like the big brother, whatever. All of his friends were there, and I was like more excited to see them than see Tom. I was like, oh.
It's true. This is true.
You know, so many guys, we were just having a blast. Like,
it's my little brother's wedding, the first sibling to get married of yours. And all you care about is all my buddies who are going to be there.
Yeah. I just wanted to tell, you know, do my speech and tell everybody about one free throw and you missed it and the whole thing. You know, okay. It's great. Yeah.
What is this one free throw and you missed it?
You haven't talked about the one free throw on this yet? Yeah. So Tom... Tom, you started how many games your senior year in high school?
30.
Probably 30 games. And, you know, played probably more than half the minutes, right? You would say probably.
I played most of the game for sure.
Most of every game, 30 games, a lot of minutes. They played 8-minute quarters. So let's say you played 24 minutes per game for whatever. How many times did you hit the free throw line during a whole 30-game season with, you know, averaging more than 25 minutes a game?
I took one free throw, and it was against Fairfield in the playoffs. It was the
and you had one.
It was the end of the game. So this became a running joke on the team, is that I hadn't gotten fouled yet. Like, I wasn't athletic enough to, like, draw a foul. And so, like, there were no drives to the basket where I would get hacked. It was just basically I was, like, a 3-and-D guy where I was, like, making all the hustle plays. And I would
he's a glue guy. You know,
yeah.
A lot of grit, basketball IQ.
Oh, yeah. He had the long flowing hair, the long socks. I mean, he was Ben Wallace, basically, was what he was.
Except chubby.
For a 5'11".
And not 11. Completely jacked. Yeah.
5'11", not very athletic guy. But the one free throw, at least he made it. Right, Tom?
No, I didn't. So,
all right.
I get fouled, and it wasn't even a shooting. It was an act of shooting or anything. It was a 1-1 at the end of a game. We were up by like 10 points at the end of the game.
Some idiot gave you the ball to run out the clock.
And so they hacked me to extend the game, and my buddies are giggling at the game, like on the court. They're giggling because they know I haven't taken a free throw all season, and this is an inconsequential, nothing free throw. And yet to me, it's the entirety of my like existence as a basketball player. And it still haunts me to this day. I missed it. I finished the season 0-for-1. I finished my varsity career 0-for-1 from the free throw line.
And that's the big number.
Well, that was kind of the play of the speech. So that was.
So can I ask you guys, Tom, it almost sounds like to a certain extent, Chuck kind of had a parental role in your life. Like, I don't want to make it like that hard and fast, but it kind of feels a little bit like there's a bit of that between you guys.
I mean, to the extent that Mom and Dad never disciplined me, it was always Chuck and Steve. Like Chuck, I remember when I was caught smoking weed in high school, my buddy Pat was this surfer kid from Palos Verdes, California, came in baseball star, but loved to smoke weed. And so in high school, you know, we would like, you know, smoke a bowl in his basement and watch like Tony Hawk or play Tony Hawk. And it was like, you know, we were just high school kids, but Chuck and Steve found out and they don't play with that. Like they don't mess around with marijuana.
way ahead of our time there.
Yeah. And so when my parents found out and instead of like disciplining me, they sent in Chuck, and Chuck goes in there and he just like, I don't think he beat the shit out of me, but emotionally he did. Like he gave me all sorts of like emotional, like disappointment and like, you're going to end up here. And like my friends do this. And it was like a very much a jock, like you don't want to smoke weed. It was basically that, like that fried egg commercial that you see on TV. It was like Chuck was doing that to me in high school. And Mom and Dad knew that would be way more effective than grounding me for a week was sending Chuck on me.
Yeah, absolutely. There was like one rule in our house, no drugs. And Tom broke that a couple times.
Never in house. I would never smoke weed in our house, but it was, I distinctly remember being terrified that if Chuck found out. And when you talk about parental role, like that's the thing that sticks out is like, he was very much the disciplinarian and even leading by example of like, he didn't even need to say it. And I knew that like smoking cigarettes, not even a thing, like don't even touch the stuff. So.
And meanwhile, I'm like, you know, funneling a 40 in a frat house. And
So that was our weird ethical code in the Haverstraw household. I remember not being able to watch rated R movies was a thing. Even though we were able to listen to like Nas and Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre, like we couldn't watch like Risky Business or whatever it would be on TV. So it was a very weird household. And it meant a lot to me to have you as my best man and, you know, being there with all my buddies because you'd coached all of them. And it wasn't just that you were a father figure for me. It was, I think, a lot of kids to this day still look up to you, Chuck. And even though I did get better grades than you, and even though I went to the FCAC playoffs, yeah, still I was very much looking up to you rather than the other way around.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, but it's you're like a little kid that I never had. But now that I have them all, it's like,
get rid of Tom.
So much easier. One who was like 6 years younger rather than all these four running around, you know, never getting any sleep or whatever. Ugh.
So go ahead, Ben.
Oh no, go ahead.
Go.
No, I was just gonna ask, you know, it's really interesting to hear, Chuck, that kind of like you're a little bit more wild. And yet you were also the disciplinarian as you got older. And so I'm curious now as like a dad, what your parenting style is, or kind of like what your, because your kids are still pretty young, what your kind of future expectations for where the limits are of kind of like rule breaking or behavior or whatever.
I will actually give you an example from last night. So one of the twins is now, and Tom doesn't know this yet, but one of the twins has now gotten into biting her sister. They like, you know, wrestle or whatever, and Eve will like kick Grace, but then Grace will bite Eve. And we just found this out a couple of days ago because, you know, she had like a mark on her back, Eve did, and then she had a mark on her leg, and Jackie asked her, and she was like, you know, Grace bit me. And so we're trying to work through that. But anyway, I last night gave Grace a timeout because I put her on the stairs, going upstairs. And I was like, time out. You can't bite your sister. You know this. And she knows it, but she's, you know, trying to, it's like her way of winning the fight. Anyway. So I put her on the stairs. I forgot that I put her on a timeout, you know, which happens all the time. Like I'm the worst at that, of getting back to the kid who I put in timeout. And so Charlie has been like up in his room sometimes for like an hour. And I'm like, boy, it's so quiet down here. I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot about Charlie. And then, so last night I go to check on her finally after a while. She's asleep on the stairs. Like legit, she's out cold on the stairs at like 5 o'clock. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, Grace. So I'm the guy who likes to have fun with my kids and we have a blast, but, my wife would say I'm a little tougher on the boy than I am on the girls, which I think is kind of a common theme with dads. Suckers, daughters, and the boys were like, come on, dude, hit a home run already. This is getting sick.
Do you find yourself copying what dad did for you parenting wise, or do you think more about what not to do?
Yeah, here's one of the things is like growing up, my dad coached a lot. And even when I was coaching you a ton, I've always coached and helped coaching. And I found that like, I wish I wouldn't coach as much my own kid, you know, like it's, they don't listen to you and you're harder on them. And it's like, this isn't going to work. So I'm reaching that point and he's 8 where like, I want other people to coach him. And that was something I think my dad kept on coaching us.
Yeah.
I think I would like to separate it. The problem is once you volunteer to coach, you're now like pretty much going to be the coach every year. Like the league is like, hey, Chuck, you're coaching, right? I'm like, you got to have enough coaches, don't you? They're like, no. I'm like, okay, I'll coach. And then you're coaching your kid. So I think
you can't break the seal is what you're saying.
Yeah. Like if you want to do it, it's awesome. And I do want to do it. But at a certain point, it's tough for the kid and for the dad. It's not easy coaching your kid when they know how to push your buttons. You know, they're smarter than you give them credit for.
So when I'm imagining you finding out you're having a girl, so you have three girls. When you had Lainey, that must have been a shock to the system.
Absolutely. It was like, whoa, like, this is possible? I can have girls? How's this going to work?
And I remember you sitting me down being like, after she was like one or something, Lainey was one, you're like, I just want all girls. Like, I love Lainey is just the best. And not like that Charlie was chopped liver or anything, but I think you grew to just love having a daughter.
Yeah. And they're also different personalities, but absolutely this through age six, the girl has definitely been easier than the boy. Let's put it that way.
In what way?
And me or the, you know, if that's her or what, but she's like genuinely funny. I was talking to somebody the other day about it. Like, she is actually hilarious. So Charlie tries too hard at being funny, but Lainey is like just naturally, she's got the gift of comedy, which is pretty funny to watch.
So I'll
give you an example. So her cousin and Ryan and her are best friends, right? They grew up together the same age. They're separated by like 3 miles and separated by 6 months. So they've been around each other forever. So they go around the classroom one day when they're in the same class. And she was like four, I think. And they were like, oh, so Ryan, what do you want to be when you grow up? And he's like, a cop. And they go, Lainey, what do you want to be when you grow up? The ticket. And I'm like, you know, that like, that would be the relate, you know, like, I want to hang out with Ryan. So I'll be the ticket. He could be the cop and we'll just whatever. And I'm like, where does that even come from? So she's just got it, you know, the funny thing, which is cool.
How often are you having a conversation with friends, colleagues, whatever, and a subject comes up and you have to like look something up, a question really on the internet, and you're like, wow, this is really going to look bad in my browser history. It happens to me a lot, probably on a weekly basis, probably every time I'm preparing for this very podcast. I know most of you probably thinking, why don't you just use incognito mode? Let me tell you something. Incognito mode is crap. It does not hide your activity. It doesn't matter what mode you use or how many times you clear your browser history. Your internet service provider can still see every single website you've ever visited. Yeah, even that one. That's why even when I'm at home, I never go online without using ExpressVPN. It doesn't matter if you get your internet from Verizon, Comcast, AT&T, ISPs in the US can legally sell your information to ad companies. ExpressVPN is an app that reroutes your internet connection through their secure servers so your ISP can't see the sites you visit. ExpressVPN also keeps all your information secure by encrypting 100% of your data with the most powerful encryption available. Most of the time, I don't even realize I have ExpressVPN on. It runs seamlessly in the background and is so easy to use. All you have to do is tap one button, tap, tap, and you're protected. ExpressVPN is available on all your devices, phones, computers, even your smart TV, so there's no excuse for you not to be using it. Protect your online activity today with the VPN rated number one by CNET and Wired. Visit our exclusive link, expressvpn.com/dings, and you can get an extra 3 months free on a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/dings, expressvpn.com/dings to learn more.
I asked you before the show if we wanted to talk about this, and the dad pod is you know, we hit some pretty big topics that I don't think dads are normally supposed to talk about, but are very real. And it's one of the saddest, toughest moments of my life. And I was just a family member dealing with it. But you and Jackie were expecting your third child, and something happened that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't even know what exactly happened. But can you explain, Iggy, and when you started to realize that this might be different?
Yeah. I think we all go through these pregnancies, and it's, you know, it took us a while to get pregnant with Charlie to start with. But then once we had Charlie, then we had Lainey, then we were pregnant with a third, and we're like, this is pretty easy, you know, like, oh, whatever, just go through life. And she got to be about 29, 30 weeks pregnant. And I remember she wasn't feeling well. She like felt pain in her stomach, and she called the doctor. Doctor's like, no, you're fine. You've had, you know, two straight, successful pregnancies and whatever. So, you know, looking back, we probably should have gone in earlier, but whatever, it was a healthy, you know, there's no reason to think that this one wouldn't be just, you know, regular cramping or something during pregnancy. But I remember I was in a call here at the office with actually Aflac going over, you know, our plan or whatever. And Jackie calls sobbing, saying that the baby's dead, that there's no heartbeat. And I was like, what? So we go in, she had an ultrasound scheduled, and the baby was gone and had been likely for a few days. And so Jackie started getting very sick, and she, so we went, they sent her right to the hospital, went to the hospital. They started pumping her with meds and trying to get her to deliver the baby. She had had two C-sections prior, with our first two, and her body's such where it's just like hard for her to deliver. So they had to C-section to get the baby out. I think it was Friday the 13th, I think, of March. And it was brutal, and she got really sick. She was in the ICU. Jackie was after, and it was a little boy. And when they right before they delivered him, they asked if I wanted to hold him. And I said, of course. Yeah, I'll hold him. And the doctor who delivered him finally, took forever. Finally delivered him, said, you know what, actually, you shouldn't hold him. I'm worried about how you'd react to how he looks. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And she said it looked like he had a genetic issue, and that, you know, it was tough. It would be tough for the father or mother to look at. And that like kind of stuck with me. I was like, really? So we got the piece of paper with the footprints, you know, it was about 5 pounds. So there are things then that you like never think you'd have to deal with. And one of them, and I was thinking about this when Tom asked me yesterday, was that you have to decide about burial. At a certain point of you know, pregnancy, they're deemed to be like a viable baby. So I had to go to it. It's a buddy of mine who runs a funeral home here, and I had him sent over there. And I went over there, and I was like trying to pick out an urn. You know, it's just like, what is going on? Like a week ago, everything was fine, and so we're picking out this urn, and I was like, you know what? Can I just hold him? Like I want to just say, you know, I'm sorry, you know, or whatever. And so he got him, and he was wrapped up, and I just held him for a while. And it was like the nicest thing this guy could have ever done for me. And he was like, don't tell anybody, this is probably not cool. But yeah, sure. So I held him and, you know, talked to him and everything. And found out later there was no genetic issue. Found out later that something was going on with mommy, like the blood wasn't getting to the baby. Now, because the baby had been dead for a while inside her, he was just too much fluid. He like retained fluid or whatever. So, so that was a really, really tough time for us. My wife was in counseling, and you know, you're dealing with all this, and you never think after having two healthy that you'd be like dealing with something like this. So I'll fast forward to all she wanted to do. Now we were like, do we get pregnant again? You know, should we try this again? That was so brutal. Oh, and Iggy, why we named him Iggy? I'll say that. So her father is a character, Jackie, my wife's father.
Big Dan.
Big Dan. He owned a restaurant here, restaurant bar, for 30-something years. He's like a larger-than-life like guy. And so he always joked, because he has a cousin named Ignatz. Ignatz. Like, and the joke was, why don't you name one of your kids Ignatz? Like, it's a family name. You know, he knows how ridiculous that name sounds. And I was like, you know what? Fine. We're going to name this one Iggy. So this is Ignatz. It's Iggy. So we planted a tree for Iggy and all this. And so it's a big joke. Like, all right, fine. Now you can shut up about naming a kid Ignatz. We did it. So,
but did you know anyone who had dealt with something like that before?
Not to that extent. You know, miscarriages are obviously very common, but not so much that late. Like, you know, nobody had prepped you for that kind of thing where you're, you know, basically burying your son. And so, no, I mean, I had a friend, who had a few miscarriages, you know, 10 to 15 weeks, something like that, but nothing like 30. 30 was crazy. So
it was just a total like loneliness, feeling like, what do I do? Like, I don't even know.
Well, the thing you learn when you go through a tragedy of something like this, and I didn't play catch with him or some, you know, stuff like that, but he is my son. And when you go through something like that, you find that people want to relate, you know, they're like, oh, well, I lost my grandfather recently. And you're like, and it was actually told by a therapist, is like, don't let people just like project their own sadness onto you, you know, like let you talk, let it out, like just tell people. And obviously it was way tougher for my wife, cause she, you know, she almost died during this whole thing. And I have pictures of her in the hospital bed. It's, you would never think it was her. You could put your finger through like an inch into her. She was so swollen with this magnesium that they pumped her with, that she just was so unhealthy. And I was like, this is crazy. Like, I'm going to lose not only the pregnancy, but my wife, and I'm going to have to, you know, your mind just starts going. And then you have the, are we going to do this again? You know, is this just an anomaly? Like, what's the deal here? And we got pregnant like within a year, I was like, she had some spotting or whatever. And we went to the doctor, and it was 5 weeks, and they were like, you're pregnant and there are two embryos in there. Like, what? We're like, what? They're like, yeah. And they look healthy. Like, you're going to have twins. And we're like, you gotta be kidding me. You know? Cause it was like, I'm not that spiritual, but I was like, you gotta be kidding me. Like, we lose one, now we have two coming. Like, what's going on here? And I remember coming back to the office, cause I work with my dad and he had twins, and he just laughed at me for like, you know, 15 minutes straight. And I like called my mom. I was like, you won't believe this. What, Chuck? I was like, oh my God. So yeah, so we go for it.
No, I think before becoming a dad, I knew that tragedies like that were hard, but I don't think I had any level of understanding of what it would feel like. Do you know what I mean? Like, and to your point about things not being comparable, it's like, my dad died when I was 7. Like, I went through a lot of tragedy, and yet I'm still aware that before being a dad, like, I had friends who lost babies, late miscarriages, stillborns. And it was just like, oh, that's really awful. But I didn't get it. Now as a dad, I told Tom when he told me that we were going to talk about this, I don't know you. And I was legit teared up. And, you know, because there's three things that happen, and I'm sorry for taking so much time, but I'm curious your thoughts. There's one, the mourning of your son. There's two, the nervousness about your wife, right? Because both the physical and then the emotional challenge of dealing with that. And then three is how you recover as a family for the long term after that, because a lot of families can be pulled apart, understandably so, you know? And so I'm just curious what those months were like for you as a dad, because you're kind of stuck in between it happening to you and it happening around you. You know what I mean? Like your wife and I just go, I have no idea what that must be like.
Yeah, it was a really weird time. And then compounding the issue was her sister, who she's an Irish twin with, had her third child during this mourning period, like 6 weeks after we lost our third. And, you know, our whole, they grow up saying we're going to have kids the same age. We're going to have, you know, we're going to be best friends. And so there's always this reminder of our niece, who's hilarious and so much fun, you know, that there should also be a son playing with her all the time too. And
so hard.
Yeah. And we've kept Iggy's memory alive in a few different ways with our kids, you know, because that was something to them too, because we were all excited. You know, the kids were old enough to kind of, at least Charlie was, to kind of know what's going on. And so yeah, those months were really rough. I didn't know what, you know, nobody really, there's no playbook for this kind of thing, you know. And when you're an athlete and you're competitive and you're just like plowing through things, you're like, I can do this, like whatever, I'm fine. And then I remember just sitting, you know, I left the hospital for the first time, you know, after like how many days, because she was in the ICU. And I just like sat at home. I was like, you know, my kids were with the in-laws. And I was just like, what? She was like, you need to go home and sleep. Like, you need to get out of here. I was like, all right. So go home. And I was like, I should go back. You know, like, she's just sitting in that hospital bed, like, miserable. And the other thing about that time I remember is nurses are amazing. And like, what we're going through, like, forget it. And what we dealt with, which I haven't even gotten to with the twins, is made me, my appreciation for them out of control. But there was no way for them to know why Jackie was in the hospital necessarily from time to time. Like, a new nurse would come on and be like, oh, so did you have surgery? And we're like, no, we lost a baby. So it was like a constant. And I stormed out and I was like, told the head nurse, I'm like, you need to like do something. You need to put something on our door or something that lets people know before they walk in. Cause nurses are so like trying to uplift and they're like, hey, so what did you have a little, you know, it's like, we don't want to talk about it again. Like, just give us a little bit of space to breathe here. Cause it's just brutal. But yeah, it's just a lot of times there's no wing for like lost babies, you know, like there's no place you go. Like, you just end up with everybody else recovering from a terrible mishap or a you know, surgery or whatever. And so it's just, again, there's no like way to do it, you know, if you know what I mean. Like, so you just plow through. And it was a really weird time. I remember being like, oh, so this is like life, you know, like you have your two healthy kids and it's awesome. And you're like, oh, we're gonna have a third. Not a big deal. Whatever. It's gonna be like, oh, I remember joking around like, Jesus, I can't believe we're gonna have three. This is crazy. Like, and like assuming it was like a done deal, and then, you know, it wasn't. So, yeah, it was a crazy time.
Was there a moment where you're like, let's just call it after two? Like, let's not.
I was fine. I was like, you know what? We're good. You know? And then, but she was like, no, we're having three. Like, we're going to have a third. Like, we're doing this. And it was part of her recovery almost. And it was like, you know, that became kind of scary, you know, like, this is what you, like, we don't know what happened last time. Like, it, you know, could happen again.
And in some ways it did, is although it was, I remember where I was when I got the phone call that at 24 weeks pregnant with twins, that she was in labor essentially.
Yeah, it was absolutely insane. So we were, you know, we were going to have twins it was 22 weeks and we were, she was just not feeling up. And you know, we were a triple high risk pregnancy because of what happened a year before, and then twins, and you know, just, it was like, okay, we're watching you guys every week. Like, okay. So she was not feeling well. And she started like basically going into labor a little bit at 22. Now at 22 weeks, another thing that I had no idea about until they sit you down at 22 weeks and they ask you if you want to resuscitate at 22 weeks. Basically, they're not going to live without help, you know, and you have to make that decision up until the, you know, the delivery. Now, what they ended up doing is they gave her a cerclage. And what's crazy is last week there was an E60 replay, I think, of Marquise Goodwin, who's on the 49ers, who was on the 49ers, a wide receiver, who it's like a remarkably similar story. It's crazy. I was like, whoa, really? they lost the baby. Then they got pregnant with twins only, and they did a cerclage, which is closing the uterus with a, you know, basically tying the uterus shut so that they can't deliver the baby.
Which to me was like the craziest thing when you were like, all right, this is what we're going to do. And I was like, that's nuts.
Lie down to do it.
moms are incredible. I mean, just if you had any doubts that the moms are incredible, here you go.
I remember, and they were like, you know, it was like these, anyway. So we at 22 weeks, we're at Yale for a few days. And then they're like, okay, it seems like it's holding. So you just go on with your life. Like, okay. So again, at 26 weeks, she started having contractions. Now, the contractions were a problem because now the weakest point of her uterus is not where it's supposed to be, you know? Now it can burst out, you know, when the contractions are happening, or, you know, your stomach can burst, or uterus. So we're like, so they're like, okay, you got to go back to the hospital. Like, oh, great. So we go back to to Yale, and they pump her through with meds and so on. So that we averted that disaster there. Then at 30 weeks, we go into, she has an ultrasound. The normally chatty ultrasound lady was quite quiet and left the room. So I'll be right back, and comes back with a doctor. They look for a second. They say, there's no movement. You gotta go to Yale right now. And you know, they gotta figure this out. I was like, oh, okay. I
mean, did they really say no movement?
They said that, like, on a, usually they do like a 1 to 10 scale, I think, or 1 to 8, and 8 being a lot of movement, which is good. And maybe, I guess, sometimes weird, but they were like a 2. So there was a little bit of movement. There was still a heartbeat, on both of them, but yeah. So they were like, you got to get to Yale. So I get, we get all loaded up, and I'm driving up the Merritt Parkway here to go to Yale. And it's rush hour, so it's stopped. And I'm like, you know, one of those times where you're like, do I call 911? Like, if ever I'm going to call 911, it's going to be now. So I did, and an ambulance shows up on the side. The state trooper shows up first. I tell him what's going on. And he's like, okay, they get an ambulance there. And the ambulance, because I'm in Trumbull, Connecticut, they say, oh, you're going to have to go to the hospital right here in Trumbull. I said, absolutely not. And I said, my wife needs to get to Yale. They've been treating us this whole time. They know of her history. They have the best NICU on like the East Coast. She needs to go there. And they were like, no. And this is a moment, and I don't know if you guys have had one yet, where like, I'm willing to go to jail. Like for my wife and for my kids. Like I was like, I told the state troopers point blank. I was like, dude, my wife's going to Yale, whether I drive her there or this ambulance driver there. But like, if you made me wait here because, you know, saying, so anyway, so they were like, we'll check her vitals. If her vitals are good, we'll take her. She can go to Yale. All right. Check her vitals. She's 120 over 80.
Great. You know? Yeah.
Perfect. However, my wife is usually like 90 over 40. Yeah. So these dopes, sorry. We're like, oh, now she's healthy. Good to go. And I'm like, yeah, she's great. It's great. I'm like, all right, you guys. And they called a different ambulance to pick her up because that ambulance couldn't go to Yale. So the ambulance takes a year. And I'm thinking like, you guys gotta be kidding me. Like,
how are you supposed to explain to the troopers, like your entire tragedy and the history and all of it? Like, how do you not say all this and be like, are you kidding me?
it's exactly the same time as what happened the year before. It was 30 weeks, and now there are two of them in there. You know, I'm like, guy, we got to get to Yale. So anyway, we get to Yale, and they had checked her contractions. They had a whole – thank God we did the ambulance. They were able to – instead of monitoring or longer, whatever. So they do the ultrasound again. The guy looks at the thing, and he goes – he said their standard procedure is to wait to do it for 30 minutes to see the movement. And he cut it at 15. He goes, this is insane. They're not moving. We need to get them out of there. And we're like, okay. So there we go. We're getting into the delivery room. And the, you know, they deliver, they say, congrats on your daughters. And then they just whisk them away. And the nurse goes away, comes back, and is like, do you want to meet your daughters? I'm like, kid, I got two more daughters. What? But yeah. And I go in there.
Sorry to interrupt. At that point, do you know they're okay?
No. So this is when I find out. So I go in there. Each one of them has seven different doctors and nurses on them. Each one of them. And they're in plastic
bags.
They're in plastic bags to keep the heat inside. And they're being resuscitated with a thing, both of them. And
how big are they?
They were just under 3 pounds each. The head doctor, Dr. Levitt, who's incredible, but I think she's Russian or something, so I couldn't understand a word she was saying, but she's just talking about how sick the babies are. These are the most anemic babies they've ever seen. It's a 4.8 and a 7.2 hematocrit. It's like the most anemic babies ever. I'm like, okay, you guys do this. I'm going to go back in there. Like, I don't want you wasting your time talking to me. So I was like, okay, bye. And I go back in. And Jackie's like, how are they? They're great.
Yeah. Dad of the year right there is, what do you do in that moment?
Right? Like, what would you say? I was like, yeah. I couldn't possibly explain in the moment what the hell I just watched, you know? And she's not doing great too, but so anyway, so they were in the Yale NICU for 80 something days and then went to another NICU closer to our house for another 2 weeks or so. So they're in the NICU for over 90 days and they're fine. They're
amazing. Awesome.
They're normal 3-year-old girls. I mean, they're one's biting the other one, but other than that, but it was absolutely insane. And trying to manage the NICU with two other kids at home was, and it's 45 minutes away, was another challenge, but it was worth it, obviously.
You know, I, first of all, not to sound corny, but just sharing that is unbelievable. And I personally, just as a dad, you know, I appreciate it because I think hearing how you got through it and the fact that you had a second challenging pregnancy, but then you had healthy kids, I think is like a really important thing for other people. Cause like you said, there's no playbook, but the idea that like, hey, you might get hit with another challenging thing, but there could be a good thing on the other side. I think it's just like a really important thing for people. That is the playbook, right? Is I hate to say it, but like you can't give up on life type thing. And I think the most amazing thing to me, you know, not nearly what you went through, but we spent about 6 days in the NICU with my son, whatever. He was so much better. It was lighter. But what I'll just say is doctors and nurses, despite all the they're just amazing. Like what they can do to save a life is, it's like magic. It's like legit magic.
It was the most living through that. So we were in the obviously the sickest part of the NICU for the first month or so because they were very sick. They just couldn't make their own red blood cells for a long time, but whatever, they're fine now. Those nurses in the sickest NICU in Connecticut, because if a kid's really sick, they're not staying at like Norwalk Hospital or you know, St. Vincent's in Bridgeport, they're getting sent to Yale. And these nurses see some of the saddest stuff you'll ever see in your life is going on in there. And they are so positive about your kid. Like, you're, you know, one of mine was a sicker than the other. And this nurse, like, treated her like it was her own daughter and, like, gave her little bows and, like, made her a little thing and made nameplates. And, like, there, and we would talk to them every morning when we wake up, because we would come back home. Then Jackie would go up and stay with them all day. And I'd come up when I could, but I had the other two. So then, because she was breastfeeding and pumping and all that stuff, she's pumping in the car on the way to the hospital to, you know, feed our babies. So she's a superstar rock star, but she's in there like doing that. And then at night we would call them again and be like, hey, so how are their numbers? We have a little journal of all this stuff that we didn't know anything about, all these numbers. And, you know, we sat through rounds and like trying to, you know, I'm decently smart, but these people are incredible. And like, it was just those nurses. I was like, what can I do for you guys? Like, what? No. You don't have to do anything. This is our job. You know? I'm like, no.
These are angels. Yeah.
Unbelievable. So, I mean, so a story about how awesome those nurses are. All right. So first day of Eve's life, like I finally give Jackie, she finally agrees to take a painkiller to like get some sleep. And I'm like, all right. So right when she basically downs the painkiller, the attending doctor, or I forget which one it was, but ran into our room and said, you guys need to come down. Eve's not doing well. I'm like, okay. And I remember shaking as I'm pushing Jackie in the wheelchair while she's like out of it down to the floor of the NICU. And Eve's stomach was perforated by the breathing tube. And so one of the things that they always do is they measure the stomachs. And this is why, because every once in a while it can get, you know, a hole in there or whatever.
I forgot about this. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Jackie's out of it and I'm the one talking to them. And what I find out is these nurses are basically putting up a stand against the surgeon assistant who wanted to move Eve to operating room. And these NICU nurses were like, hell fucking no. You guys are doing the surgery here on the floor of the NICU. It happens all the time. And this is where we have everything. It's warm here. It's cold in the operating room. We have all this stuff here to deal with whatever might come up. And they fought back to save my kid's life again. And I'm like, yeah, what? And this, like, how is it? Are you guys real? So they did that, and Eve had this surgery where they, you know, they cut open her stomach, and so she has a scar across her stomach, which is the only way I can tell them apart because they're identical. So they do that, and then they end up being, you know, she ends up recovering really well. But it was just another example of these NICU nurses being like such badasses. I was like so impressed with them. We want to go back and visit, but obviously with what's going on, we can't.
So Eve and Grace are like the same age as Madeline, but they're 3 months preemie. So it's crazy.
So Madeline's what, January?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And they're August.
So it's 7 months apart.
But they're really like November.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. Yeah. But it is funny watching the difference. Like Madeline's riding a bike and these two are, you know, not riding a bike.
Well, she's the talk of the town here in Charlotte, where she like rides her bike to school and all the 3-year-old parents are like, how did you do that? And it's like, you just get them a balance bike and throw them on these little pedal bikes and they figure it out.
It's pretty funny. Once they decide to ride the bike, they probably will. Like they will be able to. It's just you got to do it. And so, it's partly their thing too.
So we could do a whole another podcast about raising twins, which we might do for another time. But while Ben is here, I want you to just do a little opus, quick advice to dads who are deciding whether to take a plunge in getting a minivan.
Not a minivan. Just getting a more economical multi-person vehicle.
Ben won't even go to the minivan. He's He's only has one kid right now, but to all the dads who are listening out there who are like, I mean, there's no way that the great Southwest Airline commercial of Want to Get Away, where a bunch of guys are in a weight room just lifting weights and just, you know, curling iron. And then on the intercom, it says, "Hi, the owner of the tan minivan, could you please move out of the fire lane?" And all these just jocks are looking at each other like, who's that one? And then it says, "Want to get away?" That is what I imagine Chuck is in his head before he has kids. It's like, I ain't never getting a minivan. However, our family had minivans for as long as I can remember. The Dodge Caravan is legendary in our town. The white Dodge Caravan with the wood siding with blue upholstery inside is what I remember. And so when Chuck had two kids, no minivan. But when four kids happens, what is the conversation and how did you get over that hump?
Oh, yeah. It was tough. I mean, I was like all for minivan. They're the best. I am like so pro minivan. Anybody who ever asks, I'm like, get a minivan. It makes your life so much easier. We had a, what was it, an Acadia or something, a GMC something or other for the first couple months of the twins' existence. But then we got the minivan and it's the best. It's the best.
So your evangelical minivan.
So hold on. Let me just ask this, right? You're a finance guy living, I'm assuming, somewhere in the Westport, Connecticut area.
Yep.
I would assume that, like, the suburban is the go-to multi-kid thing in your area.
Absolutely. So I have like a 10-year-old pickup truck and then a minivan. I am not fitting in with the stereotypes here. But the thing with the minivan is you just press a button, the doors open. You know, when you had the buckets, you know, you put the kids in the two of them, and, you know, they're just in a suburban, the kids have to crawl over the seats. And I don't know. We drove to North Carolina in August, 12-hour drive or whatever. We didn't stop. We never changed the twins' diapers, but that's a whole different thing. Sorry about that, even Grace, but we had to get there. We had a minivan and then we fit everything. We were down there for like a week and a half. We fit everything in a minivan with four kids and two parents. And, you know, you can't beat that. There's something to say about that. All right.
All right. Listen,
minivans rule.
in the past week, I've had this debate and I included Tom in it, partially because of the dad pod and partially because the more I've become friends with Tom, the more I think we actually have like really similar dual sides of our kind of personalities. It's like, hey, like we're a little competitive, like want to achieve success. But then we're also like math people who are like economics and being
efficient with our
responsible
purchases.
So I've been going back and forth on this Toyota Highlander, which is more or less a minivan, right? Like it's getting there.
Come on. Ben, you're kidding yourself, man. You're talking to a minivan owner.
Come to Westport, Connecticut, ride around in my minivan. It's going to change your life.
by the way, that line right there is just a funny thing just to put out there. Listen, come to Connecticut, ride around in my minivan with me.
It's going
to
change your life.
Listen, you're not the first person I've had this conversation with. Come on down. Let's hang in the minivan, drive around. It has its own vacuum cleaner. I mean, come on.
Well, listen, I have one more thing. I didn't bring this up with Tom, but I think it would be remiss for us not to bring it up quickly because you are wearing it on your hat because – it is something, a subject matter that means a lot to me as well. But since we're talking about the dad pod, I wanted to ask you guys to just briefly talk about how important your mom was to you guys. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And also tell people what they can do to help out. So I want to use this as a chance for you guys to shout your mom some love, even though I know you do it all the time.
Yeah, I guess. Well, yeah, let's do it. Patty Pink Pants.
Patty Pink Pants.
Always the loudest mom in the stands, you know? She's a rock star.
Yeah. Just an incessant siren in the basketball gyms. Screaming for us. Yeah.
I think so. One of the things I remember is that I remember telling her I was going to start junior year in varsity in basketball. And she's like, oh, that's nice. And I was like, no, mom, I'm serious. She's like, oh, yeah, sure. I'm like, mom, like, I'm fine. And she, like, didn't believe me until literally, like, the first game. And I think that was why she was so loud at these things. She was just like, I can't believe this is happening. she's a rock star. She's had a rough month or so. And we're because of her, we're very involved in a few different things with ALS. She, you know, I could let Tom do the Pepper Challenge thing, but she inspired us always to give back to the community and to help people, right? And some of the most vulnerable people are people who have ALS, and they literally don't have a voice, right? So my mom can't talk. She's texting us and emailing us with her eyes right now. But we have gotten involved with a few different organizations. We love the people at ALS TDI. I love the people at IMALS. We've been working behind the scenes on a few things that we're hopefully going to announce soon, but the ALS, those people need as much awareness and help as they can, because it's just brutal. The disease is brutal. We, Tom and I, have lost, I don't know how many friends, more than I can count on two hands in the last couple of years. We're doing all the work we're doing with ALS, and they have families, you know, some of them with young kids, and like a father who just passed away, B. Wayne, a month and a half ago. Mm-hmm. He has two sons. One, you know, they're both basically high school aged. I mean, I can't imagine. They were like, you know, helping caretake for their father at such a young age, which is just like not fair. And there are ways to potentially find cures and treatments to this, but there are none yet. So I just implore anybody who's listening to this, look up ALS TDI or IMALS and look to help somebody, even so many people have been hit by acted, and it's just not really talked about that much. So we want to bring it to the forefront. So thank you for bringing it up. And Patty's, while we're in this, we're getting a bunch of texts saying she's doing great. So
yeah, that was happening. It was. Yeah. I was like, "Shit, Chuck! If we get a bombshell here, this is gonna be quite the podcast here." But yeah, it looks like so. My mom got what's called a trach, Ben, and a trach is a procedure, an operation where you get a tube inserted into your neck and your throat to bypass, you know, having to breathe through your mouth or breathe through your throat. And it's a necessary thing for mom, because she was having trouble breathing, and it just helps so much in terms of her energy levels. But it's also the biggest thing, and I'm glad you brought it up, so thank you. So for the past like 6 months, I've never seen my mom smile. She's had a mask that like the Bane mask, or like it just covers her face. And I guess people are like, oh, whatever, we've been wearing face masks for COVID. And it's like, no, this is different. Like she can't live without it. So it's not a matter of like, take off your face mask while we're inside. It's she can't live without it. So whenever our kids talk to her on FaceTime, it's great, but you still don't see any facial expressions. And then on Tuesday, she got the operation done and she no longer has to wear a mask. And we can finally see her face and her smile. And Chuck can tell you, when you saw your mom smile for the first time in 6 months, it is like you were a baby again seeing your mother smile. It was just – it rocked my world. And so, you know, we need more of that for ALS patients, is more wins like that, more procedures or more treatments or more medical advances to help families and help patients have those moments of just like, oh my, like there is good news in ALS. You gotta work hard to find those little pockets of wins that you can get in the ALS battle. And that was certainly one of them. We still have a long way to go here, but I am ALS. I don't remember Chuck being all that like community service oriented growing up. Like I don't remember Chuck. You
only when arrested. Yeah.
Yeah. Only when a judge ordered you to. Did yeah. But like seeing Chuck, you know, he's been through so much as a father, and as a husband, but seeing Chuck be able to take a lot of these initiatives in the I Am ALS world and ALS TDI has been really just like, as if I didn't think highly enough of my oldest brother. It's just like, he's a rock star. So what he's done for mom has been great, but make no mistake about it, Chuck is doing things for everyone's mom and dad out there that are potentially affected by ALS that can be, you know, impacted by some of the stuff that we're working on. So on that front, we hope to have some good news in the coming days. We'll keep you posted through the Dad Pod. But shouts to Patty Pink Pants, mom, yep. Raising us, raising Chuck in general. I mean, this guy had the biggest peeing problems as a kid. He wet his bed till he was like 12 years old.
On a second. So the thing that he's going to be bringing up is a little bit, you know, overblown, number one, but
what a terrible kid you were. Just
so Tom hasn't brought this up since my wedding. And when he brought
he
it up,
he peed himself until he was in high school. Come on.
So Tom's best man speech went 27 minutes.
Okay.
27.
It
was all about peeing the bed, and it didn't hit then, and it's not hitting now.
It is. Well, you might have wet yourself if you were laughing so hard, Chuck.
Oh, yeah.
Love you, Mom, if you're listening to this. And also, Chuck, I thank you for telling the story of Iggy. I think more dads, there needs to be more dads who feel comfortable talking about it, because people have dealt with this privately, internally, and kept it inside and not been able to feel like they are man enough, quote unquote, macho enough to like talk about this stuff. And it just seems so backwards, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, listen, for me as the outsider to your guys' experience, in the sense of like you guys lived through it, I just heard about it. I think it's really important, because I think knowing that these things happen is an important part of emotionally preparing for them without thinking that they're going to happen. You know what I mean? Like, I just think, and unfortunately, one of the biggest problems with kind of like heteronormative male toxic masculine, whatever the term that we want to apply today, is the fact that like, we don't actually prepare ourselves to know that depression could happen, to know that these, like, you know, so when it happens to us, we don't even know to look for it ourselves. You know, so I can't tell you how grateful I am that you were willing to talk about this stuff, because I really think you're going to have helped some people. And I'm sure that there's somebody else who listens to our pod that has gone through something, maybe not exact, but something that they can go, wow, it's nice to hear somebody else made it through.
Yeah, no, thanks. It was a crazy time. And I think actually, you know, now that you bring it up, I think being a father before this kind of thing happened, you know, helped me. It helped, you know, can you imagine going through that, those first two things, and never being a parent? Like, you may, like, why would you ever want to be a parent? You know, it was painful. But yeah, it's something that needs to be talked about more, for sure.
Well, on that note, I think we covered such emotionally important topics. I don't want to belittle it with the one or the two today, the dad or the mom.
Yeah.
But we're going to have you back on, Chuck, because I think there's a lot more fertile ground for you to spill some info on growing up Haberstroh. And we're definitely going to have a part two.
Yeah, I welcome that. You know, this one, I didn't really get a chance to really destroy Tom like I had thought maybe would happen. But, you know, there's always time. Whenever you need me, I'm here. If his head gets too big, I got info. It's fine.
To be fair, his head has gotten a lot smaller in recent years. Tom has done a good job of going reverse dad bod. I got to give the dude props.
Oh, no.
I
was shocked to see how chubby you were in college and post-college years and how fit a dude you are now.
I'm not fit. Look at me in seventh grade.
I was going to say, look at you, that baby picture, whatever. Well, first of all, the one on the passport photo, but the other one of your gut hanging out, like you've been drinking, you know, 30 a day for like 2 months, standing there naked in Brazil. That is a classic that needs to come up again.
Yeah. It looks like I swallowed a basketball.
Yeah.
We're going to find you the photo and get that in for the post on social. Chuck, thank you so much. Tom, thank you for letting us have this moment with your brother. And to everybody out there, I would just say, find your charity and give to it, right? Whether it's hospital NICUs, whether it is ALS foundations, whether it's cancer societies, I promise you that you're going to help save someone's life. And, you know, I just think it's an important thing because we're all dads or kids. So thanks a lot.
Amen, brother. And doesn't it mean that since you and I are hosting this show that I have to okay any new guest? So if Chuck wants to come on to destroy me, I can veto that?
No, you don't get that.
What? I know where he lives. I mean, I could just show up. I mean, really.
Yeah, you could drive down in the minivan.
You're dang right. I'm driving that thing.
Chuck already messaged me his phone number. We're going to become boys. Listen, it's over.
Damn it. We just did this. All right, Deez.
All right, bro.
Thanks, guys.